Welcome to the Backpack Show, everybody, where we discuss songs from the 80s and 90s.
That's what you specialize in. Song lyrics.
Song lyrics, hip-hop lyrics from the 80s, 90s, and the aughts.
Without telling people that they're song lyrics. So right. They're just like, when you start saying weird things.
So if we weren't going to talk about song lyrics, let me bring you back to the subject. What are we going to talk about today?
As we always talk about, Chris, we're talking about success, and we bring you insights from unusual places.
Which unusual places are we visiting today?
Dr. Deidre Franklin is Chief Program and Equity Officer at Oliver Scholars. We're going to talk with her about her career focused on inclusion, access, and the psychological well-being of historically marginalized groups. Really excited to talk with her. And we're going to talk about CBD, all about it, the essential guide to CBD. We're going to talk with the author, Martin A. Lee, is here. He's the co-founder of Project CBD.
That's a lot of things to cover. So, ready? Hi, Coach is here. Buckle up. It's time to get smarter.
Welcome to the Backpack Show with your hosts, Chris Brogan and Carrie Gargone. Boom shakalaka.
If I donated some more Rally Creator coins, do you think that guy that makes these intros could make a couple new ones?
I'm sure.
I think I'd ask him for that. He's a good fellow.
You should ask your friend with the logo if he can update me when I change my hair, because COVID hair is going.
Oh, that's a good point.
Pretty soon. Kate says projectcbd.org is an awesome resource. There's a whole book, Kate. A whole book.
Martin Lee already has fans.
Yeah, we're going to talk about it.
So first, we're going to bring out Dr. Deidre Franklin. We're going to talk all about education, learning, scholars, and why Oliver? I guess that's my first question. What's this Oliver business about, Dr. Franklin?
What is Oliver? Well, Oliver is an organization that looks for high-achieving Black and brown children in New York City, in the five boroughs. And we help the children and their families apply to private schools, both boarding schools all around the country, as well as private schools within the city. And then we follow them throughout. I know that sounds creepy. We follow them. We actually don't follow them in that way. But we do follow them throughout their high school and college experience in making sure, you know, that they have the resources that they need to be successful.
What happens without this going on? What are they missing? Where do they get pushed into the cracks? And what are we doing to make that not happen?
Well, I mean, part of our philosophy at Oliver is that, you know, all children really need is an opportunity, which is why, you know, our saying or our what do we call it? I can't think of the word, but it's
motto, opportunity.
Mission statement?
No, it's not mission statement. Oh, why am I blanking?
Motto?
Yes, there you go, motto. It's opportunity unlocked. And so we're here to provide opportunity for the young people. We have many young people in the school system in New York, you know, that are rock stars. And sometimes within the public school system, depending on the communities that you live in, you know, you're really not able to flourish, right? You're there. And a lot of our kids will tell you when we pull them from the their middle school, their public schools, they'll say, I didn't have to study. Like, I aced everything. So you all want me to study? When they come into our middle school program before they actually apply, what's comical to the staff, right, is that the kids are like, we got this. They're all A students. They come to us, you know, with phenomenal grades. And then we sort of drop them in this immersive experience where we give them extremely rigorous work to prepare them to apply to these schools. And they're like, I didn't do well. I got a B. I don't understand. You know, so at the end of the day, we really want to provide opportunities for young people who are rock stars. And all they need is just a little bit of something to kind of push them, you know, into success.
So how do you identify these high potential students? Do you look at test scores? Do you take teacher recommendations? Is it a combination of things?
It's a whole host of things. And actually, right now, we're at the back end of our admission season, which can be exhausting. Typically, we go around the city and we form relationships with schools, community partners, grandmas, grandpas, aunties, uncles, cousins, whomever. And then you have an opportunity to apply. When you apply, you submit a video talking about all the things that you aspire to do and all the things that you actually do. And we also look at your state test scores. We look at your report cards and we ask, you know, recommendations from teachers as well. So we're looking at the child holistically to see, you know, who out there, you know, are just rock stars and they just need this opportunity to take them to the next level.
Academically, anyway, there's a lot of opportunities to show people representation as well. Like one of the things that we hear over and over again in every different instance is that with a little bit more visibility and understanding of seeing other people that look like them doing what they want to do, that helps a lot. For instance, a few weeks back, we had a chance to interview director Thompson, who wrote created a documentary called Woman in Motion, which was all around Star Trek's Nichelle Nichols, you know, Lieutenant Uhura, and what she meant to the space program and science in general. So I'm just curious, is that part of the process in Oliver Scholars? Is that another piece that gets molded in there? Is, you know, bring people who have come before to show them what they're going to be in a few years?
I mean, with that, I would say, you know, that would be more around our alumni network. You know, we have a whole big giant alum network, you know, and from that perspective, we can show them, look, they went through everything you went through. I think the biggest piece about Oliver is really helping to just sort of diversify the educational space. I mean, Oliver was founded by John Hoffman, who went to a boarding school, and the boarding school called upon him to say, hey, you know, we're looking for Black and brown children. You know, do you know any, you know, who might be interested in attending the boarding school? And that's sort of how Oliver started. He identified some folks and, you know, the rest is history. So I think that's the biggest piece. It's just beginning to diversify spaces that traditionally have been predominantly white.
There's a comment here from Kate that says, our friend Gabby, who comes and checks out the show now and again, just partnered with someone to motivate and help teenagers who come from nothing get scholarship money for college. Should they perhaps reach out to you? Now, this is a New York specific initiative, right?
Yes, this is New York.
So are they in New York, Kate? And it sounds like you're at the end of the cycle for this year.
So yes, we are. I mean, as far as for admission, but, you know, we're always looking for people to apply. Our admission season will start in the fall.
And I didn't put Kate's comment up because it would have covered at least like half of you. I thought maybe not for that.
Chuck on the screen.
Pretty much. So you've had a long career. What brought you to Oliver Scholars?
I've been in out of school time spaces for quite some time. I mean, I'm a counseling psychologist by training. And, you know, I had worked in hospital settings and outpatient settings, basically what I call kind of maintaining folks who were chronically ill. And I got to the point where I was just burnt out. I felt like I'm just maintaining right now and I want to do something different. Many of us that get in this field because we want to fix things, right? I'm really not necessarily a fixer. I'm about sort of preventing. And so I shifted from working in, you know, hospitals like Bellevue Hospital to educational spaces whereby I thought if I work with teenagers and I begin to incorporate, you know, resilience programming that boosts their social and emotional sense of self, as well as social consciousness, that the kids will be fortified to like move forward and be able to tackle life. You know, many of us didn't have that opportunity. We sort of get bumps and bruises along the way. So that's how I ended up in these spaces was, do I want to go into private practice and just see one child at a time? No, not necessarily. I just wanted to expand my reach and sort of fortify kids to kind of move forward and thrive.
What do you feel they need most of the time? You know, what are they coming to you and drinking from you that helps them keep going?
Honestly, all kids want is love. And I know that sounds cheesy. And when I say that, you know, kids want to be loved and accepted. They want to be respected and they want to be heard. And I think most times, you know, we as grown people typically typically don't do that. You know, I mean, as you said, I've been in this field for a long time, which means I'm old. I'm a dinosaur. I might not look like it, but trust me.
Well, come on,
me,
I'd phrase it like that. I mean,
hey, test me on some 70s knowledge and I'll throw it back at you. But, you know, back in the day, it was like children are, you know, they're only to be seen and not heard, you know, but young people have a lot to say and they have a lot of knowledge, you know, at every developmental stage. And so for them, you know, they just want love. They want to be heard. They want to be accepted. And, you know, my kids sometimes say, "Mommy, I want to be respected." And I'm like, "No, you in my house, you do as I say." but that's the bottom line.
I was just getting ready to test you on 70s knowledge. Who's Dapper Dan and name three people he's dressed?
Why would you put me on the spot?
I'd be like, "Oh, perhaps I can be some assistant."
I just learned about him today. He's a guy that was dressing all the good early hip hop guys with, he would take Gucci and take their logo and put it on like a leather outfit or something. And he'd put
I
like 100 tons.
Dan is. So yeah. Harlem.
And what, but why would you go there? Why wouldn't you go to like the Brady Bunch or something? Like,
oh, no, the Brady Bunch too. She's a store. Okay. Don't get me started.
See?
All right. What I'm saying. Well, here, this is going to bring it all the way around.
Oh no.
Who was their nephew who they thought might be a cause of a curse in Hawaii? Hint, it's the name of the school you work at.
Philip? Oliver.
But it was Cousin Oliver.
Cousin Oliver.
So there.
Well, okay.
He was
not
a cousin to the kids. He was Aunt Mike, Uncle Carol.
Wow.
What was the dog's name, Chris?
Got nothing.
Yeah, I don't remember. Because you saw it one time. And then the dog never came back again.
The dog was never on that show.
No.
All right. No, sorry.
You know, the show needs a dog.
Yeah, don't get me distracted. Everybody that knows me knows I will go out. I will go down the rabbit hole. So don't let's stay focused.
Oh, so how long do you support these kids for? Like, you get them into private school, boarding school, that kind of stuff. Does it continue your support through college, or like how does it work?
Yeah, the support starts in high school. I mean, we get the kids, they apply when they're in the seventh grade. And then they come to us for two summers and the school year. I mean, these kids work really hard. And then we follow them all through high school, 4 years through high school, 4 years through college. And then once they move to alum status, we still provide, you know, opportunities for alum as well. Early career alum, older alum, networking opportunities. So we just stay in sort of the support realm to continue to uplift. And most of the time, the alum are then reaching back and actually, you know, supporting the high school and college students as well.
Tiger, the dog's name was Tiger. You mentioned a couple times boarding schools. Is it important that kids be in that environment as opposed to trying to do this all at home, facing whatever challenges they've got going on there? Or do you also work with kids who still live at home and just go to schools locally?
Yeah, I mean, it's both. We have partnerships with boarding schools. And as I said, the focus initially is to diversify the educational spaces. And so there might be boarding schools up in Massachusetts or in Ohio that we partner with that, you know, the community might not be as diverse. And so we form partnerships to help bring them, you know, the brightest of the bright in New York City. And then we also have kids here in the city. There's tons of private schools within New York City. And we've got our kids spread throughout, you know, all of the boroughs attending those private schools as well.
Kate asks, have some of the scholar graduates donated to continue the funding?
The alum, absolutely. We have a lot of alum that are involved with our fundraising initiatives, as well as, you know, giving themselves. And so we're working to find alum all over. And it's just so interesting. You know, I was working on a project with ABC. We're working with, we're working with The Bachelor. Okay, no judgment. And, you know, Matt James is pulling together a camp for young people in this school in Lower Manhattan. And we were talking with the administrator of the school. And then she said, "Oh, wait, Oliver Scholar, my two younger brothers went through Oliver." So Oliver scholars are all over the place and we're always bumping into them.
And they're getting that rose.
I was like, the what? And then I realized it shows The Bachelor. Yeah. A lot of times, people who have to achieve, who happen to be black or brown, always have to be the extra. They have to be the one that's going way above and beyond. Is that part of the process at Oliver? Is that explained? Is that, do you have to say, look, this is what that means? This is, you know, what you have to come with? Or do you try to disavow that? Because anybody I've known that's like been the first of, or the number one person in their family, they said, I'm so extra. Like, I'm ridiculous extra. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, we have to, as the kids say, don't mind me, we have to keep it 100, right? Which means we have to be transparent. And we don't try to, you know, lie to the kids. We let them know when you move into these spaces, it's going to be difficult. You might be in a school where someone may have never come across a person of color, and they might make a whole host of assumptions of you. It's going to be harder for you. I mean, we're in the U.S., right? And as we all know, there's a whole lot of racism that's going on, and systems and structures and all of that, which is actually an area that I study as well. I've done research in. And so with that, we let the kids know, you're always going to have to perform at 110%. You know, when they're younger, they don't really understand that. But as they begin to move through school, they do understand that you might be just as smart as the next person. But many times the assumption is that you won't be smart. Or, you know, we had this conversation the other day, whenever people are having a conversation with black or brown folks and, you know, they speak a particular way, they're like, wow, you know, you speak really well. What does that really mean?
Biggest insult, isn't it? It's the worst. Yeah,
absolutely. But these are the types of, you know, things that we do as we're working with the young people to prepare them to matriculate into the schools, is really being honest around, you know, some of the things that they might encounter. But at the same time, letting them know you're going to get an education, take advantage of all the opportunities, have fun, but go in with your eyes open at the end of the day.
So that's so important, because we had a couple of Broadway actresses on, Jessie Hooker Bailey and Aisha Jackson. And Jessie was saying that when she started her career on Broadway, she would get cast as like an understudy, and she would see it happen over and over again. And then her white counterparts would land, you know, leading roles. And then before long, they had several leading roles under their belt. And now they're like, well, you don't have enough experience in the leading role, you know, so now you need to be an understudy again. And she would take extra courses, and she worked even harder. And it was a while before she realized that was systemic, that she was seeing something that was not about her. So I think it's really important what you're doing to explain to kids, like, hey, the system is like this. This isn't about you or your ability, because that can really, that could damage them to think that they're not as good, which is not.
And that's one of the big pieces that, you know, we do at Oliver, is to really like help the young people move into the schools feeling good about themselves, feeling good about the communities that they come from, feeling good about, you know, their family. And you're going to be different on multiple levels. You'll have some kids that'll be extremely privileged and rich, and that's fine. But you're rich in other ways. So don't think that you're less than. It just means you're different. And different is good. Different is great, actually.
I bet a lot of your alumni are really successful, and they should appear on a business success show to talk about it.
We do have a lot of successful alum.
Well, Dr. Franklin, if you want to send a few our way, we're friends of friends. So
Kate wants to work for you, apparently.
there's an admin assistant. There's an accountant. There's a scholar counselor, grant manager, a teaching assistant, administrative assistant, and associate director for alumni and college relations.
You just read the whole list.
I sure did.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to bring you backstage. We're going to say thanks for being part of the show. Stick around. We're going to ask you a few more questions before the end.
All right. I'll be here.
Thanks so much.
We have to thank some sponsors and do some things. Kate, stop asking for jobs then.
And then we're going to grab Martin Lee, and we're going to have him on to talk about CBD. So if you've wondered some things about CBD, and who hasn't, why isn't this working? We'll ask.
What do you need? I'll do it.
No. I'm good. I was saying CBD. I was making a joke. All right. Hey, if you think we're ugly, castos.com is our audio sponsor. If you just want to get our audio podcast and not ever look at our heads ever again.
That's not why people do that. They're like working out or something, or driving. They can't watch video.
Oh, hey, are you moving your fat butt back and down on a Peloton somewhere?
Oh, for Pete's
you can
sake.
Listen to our show instead of watch it. Castos.com.
If they're on the Peloton, I doubt that they're as fat as I am. I can feel my butt getting bigger right now. It's like I'm the pandemic phenomenon.
Hey, you want your own website domain? You can have a cool domain with a dot online at the end. You can just go to cbrogan.me/online, use the code Chris in all caps, and you can have your own domain.
I was already too late for carry.online, which is like painfully unfair. But you can get it, and it's less than a dollar, right, for a year if you use the code Chris in all caps.
All caps. Hey, want to make a show just like this? Use StreamYard. Whack. It is a great video product. It allows you to make a show that looks like a show instead of a bunch of boxes looking at each other.
That's how we do things like this.
Stuff. There we go. Yes. I don't know. hey, would you like to use a search engine that doesn't feed the mighty evil empire known as Google? You can go to presearch.com. It is a decentralized search engine, which we found the coolest thing out is that if you use their crypto coins and you can stake, which is like I have 100 crypto coins and I want to put my name on such and such. Our guest a day or so ago, Natasha Nichols, is doing urban farming in Chicago, and they decided to stake urban farming. And when you look that up now, it goes right to her thing, WeSowWeGrow.org.
So cool.
So Presearch, one of our sponsors that we're grateful to have, at least for the rest of today. Hey, want to go to classes? You can. Pulver EDU. You only have to pay 7 Jeff coins. What's a Jeff coin? Oh, that's another whole story. but you can use cryptocurrency to go to school. I'll give you a hint, though. One class is 7 Jeff coins. That used to be about $20. Right now, because crypto's tanking, that's like $13.
So it's
like
money super out. Cheap.
Super affordable.
Got it.
All right. I think that's all of them, right? I think that's all of them.
Let's talk about CBD.
Let's grab Martin Lee.
Let's do it.
Hello, Martin.
Ta-da.
Hello.
So I want to start with a TED talk, a TEDx talk I watched in TEDx Boulder. And it was about a young person who was dealing with a pretty bad epilepsy case. And they were having upwards of 200 seizures a day. This is back a few years ago when CBD was not available for a lot of places and a lot of people. But it turned out that when that person was given CBD for some amount of time, shortly that 200 a day came down to 2 every week or so seizures. So from 200 a day to maybe 2 every week or 2. That was the first time I thought, oh, there must be some magic in that old silk hat. I want to start with that story because I want you to talk about what you know the magic to be. And then maybe we can sort of work backwards from that into all of the things that people understand and don't understand about it and where they get stuck.
Yeah, I think what you were referring to, a little girl named Charlotte Figge, who unfortunately passed away during the COVID epidemic. But she was her case became a focus of national attention when CNN broadcast a special in which this was the summer of 2013. When Sanjay Gupta kind of did his mea culpa and apologized to the American public for misleading them about cannabis and acknowledging that indeed cannabis in general and CBD in particular had significant therapeutic potential and value. That was definitely a game changer for CBD. We at Project CBD had already been involved in this educational effort for several years prior to that. We formed in 2009, 2010. And specifically to educate the medical cannabis community in California, which is where we're based, about cannabidiol, the fact that there was a compound in cannabis that was not intoxicating, that was a very important element in terms of the medicinal significance of cannabis, and yet it had very little attention within the medical cannabis world, which was very much a THC-oriented world. THC is the high cause, the tetrahydrocannabinol, and indeed THC has a lot of medical value also. But in those days, we were emphasizing to people it's not just about THC, there's other important aspects of the plant and its healing potential, and we should be paying attention to CBD, which very few people had heard about it at the time. So when Charlotte's story was broadcast internationally, it really upped the game for CBD, and it changed a lot, because until that point it was really, we were like sort of ringing the, well, like a hunchback of Notre Dame ringing the bell, CBD, pay attention to this is important, not just because it had a lot of potential as a healing compound, But we also always emphasize the social dimensions of this, and that CBD, we felt very early on, could be key to liberating cannabis from the drug abuse paradigm, that it can break the stranglehold of prohibition, which is cannabis prohibition in the United States is deeply racist in its origins and its implementation. And in so many ways, we thought if we can move beyond cannabis prohibition, it can unlock important energies in society to move forward in a positive way. And we felt that actually CBD could be very key in that that effort. That was part of it. I mean, first and foremost, it was really about, can this help people? Because when we heard about CBD long before Charlotte and her story, it was really about what scientists were learning when they were experimenting on mice and rats. And when we heard about this, it was really phenomenal. We, you know, as journalists, we were covering the science of medical cannabis. And really, it was a time when scientists were talking to each other. Few people had heard about CBD. We were hearing about these amazing things that CBD was doing to the brains of sick mice. And we thought, well, wow, if that was available to people, this could really be a game changer. So for us, back in 2010, when we first started, we were working this on two levels. On the one hand, we wanted to see what would happen when people started using CBD as part of the medical cannabis experiment. Would it be anything like the scientists reporting this phenomenal results, you know, with the mice experiments? And if it would be anything like that, even a little bit, we thought this is going to be huge, and it turns out to have been the case. But also beyond just the individual potential for helping people for a lot of different conditions, a lot of different diseases, we thought this could have a big impact on a social level. To moving beyond prohibition. Now, it hasn't quite worked out that way, but this is a work in progress. So the CBD story, you know, the final chapters on this aren't yet written.
I find it interesting that, you know, as this research gets more and more socialized, as more and more people get to understand it, that there's all this stuff that's been somehow kept from the average person. Things like cannabinoid receptors, the fact that our body has these things labeled cannabinoid receptor that we never heard about until suddenly we started getting told there's a little bit of there's opportunities out there like CBD to help people in ways that maybe we weren't as aware of, for instance. I'm curious to know, you've worked really hard on keeping people educated for some amount of time. Is it easier and faster to educate people, or do you feel like in lots of ways you're in the same struggles as you were decades ago?
You know, it's a mixed bag. Things evolve, you know, and again, in the early going, no one had heard of CBD. So it was a matter of letting people know it existed. And these days, yes, a lot of people have heard about CBD. There's also a lot of misconceptions. There's a very aggressive advertising promoted by the CBD industry, which for better or worse, you know, has brought CBD to people's attention on the one hand. On the other hand, it's sort of encumbered by some baggage that an advertising often carries with it. So, you know, it's a matter of debunking different misconceptions. In the early going, we were saying to everybody, it's not just about THC. There's a lot more to the plant. These days, we say to everybody, it's not just about CBD. There's a lot more going on in the plant. Don't focus just on CBD. Remember, the whole plant matrix that CBD is a part of is really what's key in terms of unlocking the healing potential. And indeed, yes, CBD isolates. You can get products now on the internet. It's not regulated. It's a bit of a crapshoot, but there's some good material out there and there's some not so good material. But the focus is on isolates, CBD as an individual compound. And what's missing is the understanding that CBD is a part of, as I say, the whole plant matrix. You have these different components in the plant, many of which have medicinal value, but yet when they put together, they form what scientists refer to as an entourage effect or ensemble effect, so that the therapeutic impact of the whole plant is greater than any individual component or the sum total of the components, for that matter. That's what's being lost now with this push on CBD, and eventually the pendulum will swing back, I believe. And that's, again, that's our mission, you might say, to stay a little bit ahead of the curve and to try to keep everybody honest about this, because there is a lot of value here, but there's also a lot of misconceptions. And ultimately, there'll be some disappointments as well, where people will take it, well, why isn't it working for me? Well, there's a lot of reasons where that might be the case. Or you might have these remarkable effects where little children who are suffering from catastrophic seizures disorders will have really, I mean, it'll say literally be a lifesaver, which is kind of ironic because back in the day when cannabis was being made illegal during the Reefer Madness period, it was referred to as the assassin of youth. And now we see the CBD rich oils, they're the savior of youth, at least in some cases. So we have a lot to learn. And because of prohibition, because cannabis was made illegal, we lost the kind of connection to understanding the therapeutic value of the plant, which actually been part of human culture going back thousands of years. So it's a very exciting process on the one hand. On the other hand, it's encumbered with a lot of the same pressures that people experience in different ways in modern life. You know, the push for advertising, the big money moving in, the lack of access that some people have because of their disadvantage. You know, CBD is not cheap, let's face it. And the fact that cannabis, the story in the United States has been so tied up with racism going back to the Reefer Madness days. And we're still in that period in a sense. We're in the Reefer Madness light period. So, you know, all these things is part of the mix. And for us, it makes for an exciting, both intellectually engaging endeavor to be engaged in this area with CBD.
Because we have really a question from Coach Woodard. He asks, what is the primary way to absorb CBD, oils or others?
There's a lot of different ways, actually. I think the most prevalent way now is through these oil extracts. You know, when we think of marijuana, we think of smoking a joint. And that's a very effective way of inhaling or consuming the cannabinoids in the plant. CBD is a cannabinoid, THC, there's over 100 others. But these days, most people aren't smoking THC. They're using tinctures, gel caps, gummy bears, you know, different edibles. It could be applied in topicals for application on the skin. If you have an ache or an itch or something like that, there's many different ways to take it, and each has their advantage and disadvantages. Some act quicker. If you need a very quick effect, actually inhaling it is very effective. If you want a deeper and longer lasting effect, absorbing it through eating it somehow. But there's leave it to the genius of a marketer to come up with different ways. There are so many ways now. There's water soluble CBD, and you can drink it with your beer in some places. It's crazy. A lot of it is dubious too, you know, claiming that there's now sportswear. That you can go jogging, you can have running pants, and it'll have CBD somehow embedded, and it'll be absorbed through your skin. It's not something I would
recommend. Come on. Like every other advertisement, you got to use your head. Kate says, there's the Delta 8 CBD THC thing going on right now regarding the farm bill. Do you have any thoughts or stance on that? I don't know what that is.
Yeah, you know, Delta 8, what we think of as THC is typically called Delta 9 THC. It's a sort of a version of THC. Slightly different, you have Delta 8 THC, Delta 10 THC. And if it's a THC, it's likely to be psychoactive or mildly intoxicating, which is the case with Delta 8. There's been efforts on the part of certain lawyers and certain business folks to claim that Delta 8 is legal, whereas Delta 9 is federally illegal still, because it comes from the hemp plant. And this is not actually really accurate. The hemp plant, you can extract CBD from it. And then you can chemically use a process to synthesize Delta 8 from the CBD that's been extracted from the hemp plant. So you're not actually getting the Delta 8 directly from the plant. And we always understood that means it's illegal, according to the federal government. And now you have many states lining up to like almost like a mad rush to proclaim that Delta 8 is not generally legal. It's because it's chemically synthesized from CBD rather than coming straight from the plant. So, you know, the problem, again, this is all unregulated. If you buy a Delta 8 product and it's proliferating on the internet, at least momentarily, I think there's going to be, we're in the beginning of now a crackdown. You don't really know what you're getting. And frankly, I wouldn't recommend that people go vaping Delta 8 vape pens. You just don't know what's in there. And in some of these vape balls, there's all sorts of gnarly stuff. And it contributed, remember before COVID, we had a crisis with illness from inhaling vapors from some of these unregulated products. And you just don't know. So if it's about getting high, if that's what you want, stick with the Delta 9. It's all over the place. You know, you don't need to go to a chemically synthesized version. And we are in a situation now where most states – cannabis is legal in one form or another. Majority of states, it's legal for medical use. And we're approaching the point now where a majority will be legal for just adult use. So why do we need Delta 8? It's just one of these momentary flashes in the pans that people are jumping into that space to make a little money while they can. And it's not something we're particularly excited about at Project CBD.
Martin, what can people expect in this book, The Essential Guide to CBD? Carrie has a copy in her hand, but I haven't read one just yet. What can people expect in it?
Well, I should point out, this is a collaboration between Project CBD and Reader's Digest. And Reader's Digest is a vast media universe of its own in the United States. And we were excited to work with them because it gave us a chance to speak to an audience we were not necessarily already speaking to speak to an audience that is not involved with cannabis. You know, we emerged from the medical cannabis milieu in California. And for that reason, we really jumped at the opportunity. It's a guide for beginners, and yet I think even scientists will find something interesting here. It explains, oh, there's your cat, beautiful. There's a chapter on CBD for pets as well.
I'm going to need one tiny second here. Sorry.
Whoop, whoop, whoop. Feline invasion. I repeat, we have a feline invasion. Chris, hold very still. Do not turn your head. For the love of Pete, don't turn your head. Oh, the humanity!
Well, we published an article on developments in the veterinarian community. They've launched a veterinarian society for cannabis, so that vets can give or prescribe or recommend cannabis for pets. You know, what's interesting is when these laws for medical use started getting passed in California and other states, it was initially in California in 1996, veterinarians weren't part of the mix. It was legal to recommend cannabis for a human being if you were a doctor, but vets were not part of the game. So they've had to struggle to be able to assert the right to recommend cannabis for pets.
And, come on, Chris, and, chill that cat out.
That is my cat, and the name is Fat Cat.
Is it?
Beautiful, legendary cat, and she has gotten her moment in the sun. We've got a lot of offers from modeling agents that she should be part of them. She should have a steady job. Anyway, that's our little secret with that article.
It
features veterinarians who are doing some very important work. These are generally holistic veterinarians that work with acupuncture and herbs and other non-pharmaceutical techniques in addition to the standard veterinary medicines. And they're the ones who are most open-minded about integrating cannabis into their, and CBD in particular, into their practice. And they often warn that, you know, THC is really tough on dogs. If you're thinking of, this is going to help my dog, stay away from THC, stay away from chocolates, because actually animals can have, the dogs in particular can have very bad reactions.
So. More for me.
Yes, okay. Just to sum up the question, though, Chris, you know, the Essential Guide to CBD, but it's three parts. It explains the basics about CBD, what is it, where it comes from, how it's made, you know, how it works in the brain, why it does what it does, why it has the different therapeutic effects. And then we go through another section where we look at about 30 different health conditions, medical conditions, relying on what the science says, because there is a lot of science in this area now. It's just not well known. And then the third part of it is just how you can navigate this, you know, rather challenging CBD landscape if you want to actually buy products. What do you do? Where do you begin? What should you avoid? You know, what should you keep in mind if you're making choices to, you know, put down some money to do this? This is very popular now, CBD. Obviously, people are buying this stuff. It's projected now, you know, $25 billion industry in a couple of years, just CBD alone. I am not, you know, wowed by all this. When we started, it was never a matter of, oh, we're going to kick off a big industry. It was really a matter of, let's see if it's going to help people, and let's see if it's going to help us move forward as a society, dealing with some of these problems that are embodied by, you know, the so-called war on drugs.
Well, Reader's Digest has gotten way cooler, everybody. You heard it here first.
I couldn't get over it when you said that. Lynn pointed out, I've read your excerpt on endocannabinoid tone, and very good. I'm an RN 35 years, and you explained it very well. So there you go.
Well, one thing is not just about CBD. You know, it's about, we always emphasize if you're going to take CBD or cannabis for health reasons, use it as a part of a healthy lifestyle. You know, what exercise are you getting? What are you eating? Are you sleeping well? And the other really important pillar of health, not just sleep and exercise and diet, is community and social relations. You know, what's happening there in your life? And, you know, that's all a part of it. We like to emphasize the holistic connections. We see healing as part of us. You know, the social dimensions is very, very important. It's not just a matter of popping a pill or a gummy or a gel cap, although it can be very helpful.
I would not say no to my gummies, but I'm going to bring back Dr. Franklin. Hello. So here we are.
In the '70s, Reader's Digest did not talk about CBD.
Yes. Trust me, they didn't. Or if they did, they were talking about cannabis in a very pejorative way.
Correct.
My dad had a stack in the bathroom. There was nothing in there about CBD. Can confirm.
Dr. Franklin, any thoughts and feelings on this particular project or anything that we've heard in the last little minute?
I mean, I was just sort of floored around the animal, you know, giving animal CBD. I actually have a dog that's 130 pounds and he's extremely anxious. So I think we're going to have to look into giving him some sort of CBD so he doesn't feel like he has to eat everybody that comes into the house just because he's anxious.
Well, Leslie said that she has a friend whose older dog was prescribed CBD and it made a huge difference and so much better than prescription drugs.
The stuff works. You know, if you know how to use it, it works. And it definitely works on animals. My cat has benefited from that as well, my old cat. So
I keep trying to get Chris to just schloop the cat off the desk, but he won't do it. He says the cat will be louder if he schloops it off.
If I push it off the desk, that makes worse noises. I was just wondering if your really big dog's name is like Christopher Wallace. I think that would be a great name because he'd be like Biggie.
You're guessing what the dog's name is? No way. Yeah. The dog's name is Tiger, obviously.
My like dog?
Your dog.
He's guessing at your dog's name.
My dog's name is Cappuccino. We call him Chino because he's an Italian Mastiff.
Oh, that's a beautiful creature.
So that's a thinker right there. Like, you got to know what kind of dog you're looking at before you'd be like, that's pretty clever.
Well, my cat's name is Fat Cat, and she's not fat, but she adopted us. She was a stray just when the economy was collapsing about, you know, a little more than 10 years ago. And we had to deal with the fat cat phenomenon some way, so we named our cat Fat Cat. So she's fatty for short, and she's a beautiful being.
My first cat was Busy, short for strabismus, because his eyes were crossed and different colors.
Oh,
my mom made me get rid of him because Busy used to miss the litter box because he couldn't see correctly.
My cat's name is...
Oh, and here's our person of the day. Kaboom!
It's got to be like Terminator or something really masculine, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh. I'm giving Lynn Cooper person of the day. My grandpa always had a pile of Reader's Digest in the bathroom. That is absolutely the only... Only right answer to where to put Reader's Digest.
Obviously.
Only right answer. Okay, listen, we have to get out of here. So we could ask you one question we've asked every guest who's ever been on. What goes in your backpack? This could be something physical, like avocado, or it could be something metaphorical, like dreams. Carrie, what's a good physical thing someone could put in their backpack?
Extra set of teeth.
Our friend DJ Cumberbund goes live today on Cameo, so you can get him to say extra set of teeth to other people by paying him money. Cameo. Or what's something metaphorical they could put in their backpack?
Kindness.
That's a good one. I'm going to start with Dr. Deidre Franklin. What goes in your backpack?
Change is actually a good thing. I say that because most of us do not like change. We're freaked out by change. We are creatures of habit. And while habits are good, change is good as well. And I think that's sort of my mantra coming through this whole COVID, you know, time that we're in, is that, okay, this has not been a good thing, but there are some changes that have come as a result of COVID that has made things better. I tell you what, my kids wash their hands more often. My house is more clean. So change is good. That is what I keep in my backpack at all times.
I love change. That's why I changed your position in our little group.
There you go.
Awesome.
Oh, well, then let me help you.
Oh.
You see? That
one. Doesn't that feel so much better? He's like, no, it does not.
Before I lose my mind, Martin Lee, what is something you should put in your backpack?
Oh, God, I'm so stumped. You know, I'm thinking of something that would be hard to keep in a backpack, like a nice little bottle of ghee, clarified butter, which to me is, I love it as a sort of a, I eat a teaspoonful every morning, but it has to stay solid, you know, otherwise it melts like butter. And you'd be, so some way of having in a backpack where the ghee would stay hard and you can dip into it whenever you like.
Insulated backpack, I guess. Kate says, hey,
or a Yeti mug.
What does person of the day get? You get an apple. You just have to wash it yourself and purchase it.
Right. And you can wash it first, then purchase it, and then eat it.
Yeah. Not a subscription to Reader's Digest, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Although apparently they've gotten really cool with a lot of things since I was a kid. So I'd be willing to go for that subscription maybe now.
I think ghee's a really good answer. You can actually put cannabinoids in ghee very well. And
yeah, you could.
You could do all kinds of things with that. At least as far as I know, and my mom and dad aren't here to disavow this, my grandmother may or may not have partaken long before it was legal up in the fine state of Maine, which has incredible laws on this. Now it's like one plant per human or something like that. It's craziness, shenanigans. But I will say this, that she definitely supported the idea of ghee, and here's how I know. You know, be a